Hi, everybody. My name is Lars Nilsson. I program at Austin Film Society, and I'm really happy to be sitting here with my counterpart, who programs over at Alamo Drafthouse, not just Ritz, but at Alamo Drafthouse generally, Tommy Swenson. Thank you for joining us, Tommy.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
Well, it's always a pleasure to see you. It's always a pleasure to see you at one of your screenings, and it's just always a pleasure to see you around. And it's also, there's a thing that we programmers, we kind of know each other's jobs in a way that other people can't possibly know. So, like, when I see another programmer, it's like I know kind of what he does for a living, and I sort of know where he is in his cycle in terms of calendar, in terms of booking, and things like that. So it's always, I think when a programmer meets another programmer, you always are, you immediately kind of go into programming talk.
We've been down in those mines together, can read the calluses on the hands.
Yeah. And so if a programmer talks to me and is like, "Hey man, how's it going? I wanted to talk to you about this," I'd be like, "I'm trying to, you know, hump this calendar over the finish line." They'll be like, "Okay, no, I got it. When do you go to press?" "Next Tuesday." "Okay, I'll talk to you next Friday." It's kind of like programmers sort of know each other's and know each other's struggles. I'm curious because I don't know how many people know you. I always have this happen when I talk to our members or whatever. They'll be like, "Yeah, we hear you talking before the screenings and we read what you write, but we don't really know you." And mm-hmm. I think that might be the case, you know, also with you. And I feel like people would like to know Tommy Swenson a little.
Probably even more so. I don't really make an effort to have myself be a public face too much. I'm there at screenings and I like to give introductions. But beyond that, I'm not trying to attract a sort of personal following at all. But what? How can you get to know me better?
Well,
ask some of those leading questions.
Tell us a little bit about yourself. And I also want to talk about that whole sense of a programmer being a public face. But that's for later. I'll make a note of that, and we talk about that later. But where did you come from?
Well, you hired me.
But okay.
Let's
assume that people don't know that.
I'm from the Northwest. I grew up in Tacoma, lived in Seattle for a long time, went to college at the Evergreen State College in Olympia, and worked for many years at Scarecrow Video up there, the preeminent video archive in globally, really, who have miraculously survived the widespread demolition of the video store industry and transformed themselves into a pretty vibrant nonprofit community center these days. And their collection is intact, and it's really inspiring. And pretty much everyone who I worked with when I was there is still there, or rather, everyone who's still there has been there since I worked there, and mm-hmm. That, if anywhere, is my home.
Like, what did you do there?
Well, I checked movies out and I put movies back on the shelf. I gave recommendations, and that's about it. I grumbled about my life going nowhere, but you can really look back on those as the halcyon days.
In an interesting way, like these video stores were, you know, they were kind of like academies. In a way, because like you had to really be able to hang with, you know, in order to work at Scarecrow, you probably had to know your stuff, and you had to be able to hang with these other people, and then you're, you know, acculturated with everything movie wise, in particular people's weird little obsessions.
It's an incubator, and yeah, I mean, they were very generous of hiring me in the first place because I was going in there, I did not know my stuff, but I was going in there almost daily as a teenager, and asking for a job, but I couldn't get it because they had pornography and you needed to be 18 to rent that out. So on my 18th birthday, I went in and said, "Now's the day." And they gave me a job. It was great. Didn't finish high school. Figured out how to transfer my credits through multiple school districts so I could just be done with that. And spent senior year instead just watching movies. And yeah, it really is the ultimate incubator for if you're going to be a film programmer, if you're going to be a film critic, if you're going to be involved with film on any level. I mean, hopefully filmmakers have some sort of that experience in their background. It seems like perhaps too many do not these days. Mm-hmm. But if you want to take film seriously, you need to put in those, what I call the video store years. And that could come from different places. It doesn't have to be specifically a video store. It could be working in a theater or in some other way, exposing yourself, giving yourself the opportunity to be watching 3-4 movies a day.
Yes.
Not having a lot of personal relationships, not having a very vibrant social life, not doing a lot creatively, But just taking that plunge and just seeing what everything you can see. And a place like Scarecrow just sort of, by the way it's organized, really sort of facilitates that sort of deep rabbit hole where you get sucked into one weird vortex corner of a thing. You're like, oh yeah, like, I love Westerns. I did spaghetti Westerns. I've seen dozens of them. What's there? Oh, East German Westerns. Let me dig into this. Let me watch
Sauerkraut Westerns, yeah.
Winnetou movies.
Right, right.
And there's a section there, so it's like, the way that the Scarecrow is organized and curated is just like, it's using architecture to hold your hand as you walk through the world of like film history. It's really incredible. In a way, it almost functions as like a memory palace. When I want to think of a director's filmography, I go into Scarecrow in my mind and I look at that shelf, and that's like how I can remember what exists.
And there will be like a director section for like Harold Reinl or something. Like, sure. There would be like director sections for people that like nobody's into.
Alfred Vorer right next to him. It's just like, all right, man.
And it makes people, I mean, and the effect that that has, you know, architecturally.
It's chaos. It's for someone who just wants to like find a movie, it's infuriating. It is not customer friendly on that level. You have to be willing to walk out with something that's not what you came in for.
It's more labyrinth than library.
Yeah.
But that's what's so interesting, I think, about it, is that the very fact that there's an Alfred Vorer section, and there probably isn't actually an Alfred Vorer section, maybe there is.
There is a creamy section.
Okay. The very fact that there's a creamy section focusing on German Edgar Wallace and Brian Edgar Wallace adaptations, you know, gives that heft. So it gives that the heft of saying, okay, well, this is a whole thing that I could be into, and that's based on someone else's obsession, whoever made that section, whoever initially started getting into those.
Yeah, and even back to, like, thinking about those Red Westerns. The Red Westerns are the Russian ones, actually.
Mm-hmm.
But that, like, the Western subsections there, you don't just have a Singing Cowboys section. You have Singing Cowboys subdivided by Singing Cowboy. It's just like, this is an infinitely recursive, like, the deeper in you go, the bigger it gets sort of thing.
It as a visual representation for the inside of a, we'll call it a programmer's brain, and I'll explain what a programmer is a little bit more, I think, in that I kind of think when people talk about a poet, you don't really kind of go to school and become a poet. You're just kind of a poet or you're not a poet. It's just the way your brain works as a poet is, you know, you might be a poet, and there are tons of poets maybe walking around right now or working at HEB or whatever, and they're poets, you know, whether or not they're publishing in tiny quarterlies. I think with programmers, it's sort of the same way. It's like, you're talking about your woodshed years, you know, where you kind of got your craft together working at Scarecrow, but I think if you talk to most programmers, they all had sort of woodshed years. I never worked at a video store, but I would keep big notebooks where I, like, would rank every movie that I saw with, like, a system of, like, little scores that I would keep on it and then little mm-hmm. notes. And then I would make whole, like, you know, lists of this kind of movie or that kind of movie. Mm-hmm. And I would make videotapes for my friends where, you know, I'd get a TDK 160 and I record in LP mode, like, four movies. Mm-hmm. And I would give, like, different friends that with, like, extensive program notes for them to watch. And it's like, I never thought of myself as working as a film programmer someday, but clearly I was a programmer. And I would make, you know, video, like, audio tapes also, where I would, like, make mixtapes.
There's just a certain worldview that's necessary, and part of it is just purely obsessive, of just that list-making aspect and that exhaustive viewing aspect of when you go into something, you seek out all of the examples of it. You watch the director's whole filmography. You do it in chronological order so that you can understand the way that it developed over time. And just, like, that sort of obsession has to be there. But then the actual sort of point of view that you then take on of how would this mean anything to anybody else? What is the entry point? How does one thing link to another? How do the corridors of those labyrinths connect? Where are the dead ends and where does it open up onto the infinite beyond?
Yeah, that's definitely the next step. That after that's sort of the tunneling out of the woodshed a little bit, is how you then translate that, all of that sort of, you know, you've built the library and the card catalog. And by the way, I'm not the kind of programmer. I'm not the kind of programmer that watches every single thing that a director did in order or things like that. I will sometimes watch, like, like there's a lot of Fritz Lang movies I haven't seen, for instance. I'll just be like, okay, it's so rich that I will take a little bit here and there, like through my life.
Yeah, and well, there's certainly now when you're actually doing the job, there's just no time to do that. So that's why I think that having those formative years to do that work mm-hmm. is important, where it seems at the time just like, why? What am I doing with my life? All I do is watch movies. But that's actually so... It's work. It's preparation.
That was your grad school, especially for people who know. So you're a high school dropout too?
Well, I have a high school degree and a college degree.
You do?
But I only did 3 years of each. I see. Through some careful finagling.
Okay, that's good. Damn it, I thought I found another high school dropout that I could commune with. There's certainly a lot of us in the programming community.
Yeah, it's, I think the formal education doesn't lend itself much to this.
So once we start tunneling out of that woodshed, once we kind of got our chops, and we know a lot about film, we know what we like and all of that, I think that, having to then interface with the public and with a program, that's a big step.
Yeah, I mean, before that, the sort of that worldview and the skills that go along with that I'm talking about, it's not valuable at all when you're actually in the video store. What people come in with, the kind of questions they have, what really serves you best is if you're going to have a list of about 10 things in mind, mm-hmm. ready to recommend, sort of, what are you in the mood for, this, and just knowing, like, what hits. Just having a real basic hand to deal to people. Like, that's all that matters at that level. But then, yeah, sort of making that step to how can we share what now we know with a wider audience, it becomes a matter of framing and storytelling and creating entryways.
I think it's clearly something that you've got an incredible handle on. I remember when I was leaving, because I had worked for Alamo for years, and you were there, and you're like working as a video editor, but it was clear that you were a programmer. I mean, it was obvious like that Tommy's clearly a programmer and should be a programmer. That when I was leaving, we had a conversation where it was kind of like, I think you thought I was handing off some kind of wisdom, which I had none really to hand off, other than you said something along the lines of, I'm thinking I want to just really blow out this like Edgar Wallace creamy series, and just that will be one of the first things that I want to throw out there for people. And like my advice then, which I stand by, although I think it could have gone either way, was like, wait until you've really built up some credibility where people will follow you there, because as it stands, like, you don't have credibility and name recognition yet, whereas like, you can throw a thing like out there, like an Edgar Wallace series, and people are going to, like right now, people listening to this are looking up Edgar Wallace on their phones, and people will follow you there. But now, clearly, you could do any such thing, and people will follow you there because you've established this trust.
And very specifically, that's now... We're about to do that.
Yeah, you are about to do that.
We can come back to that later. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I think that's true. And not even so much building up the name personally, but just taking Alamo, specifically in Austin, as a brand there, building up that audience over time. Obviously, I was coming in at a point where it already was huge. You, mm-hmm. Zach, Kayla, Janice, Tim, mm-hmm. had really defined it in a very clear and meaningful way. And it is... The work that you guys did is iconic, and sort of growing beyond that, we've had to sort of forge new pathways into new stuff that I think you guys would never have touched because it was so outside of that body of work that you're mm-hmm. building.
Yeah, absolutely. I think if there's a thing that we may have kind of established, and the reason why we needed to move on for a company that was going to grow is that we really had a kind of bunker mentality about our programming in a strange kind of way, where it was like we were really hunkered down and we were eager to share this with the world, and we were underdogs. Now, when an underdog cannot easily become the favorite, an underdog cannot easily become the overdog. So it does really need to have, I think, somebody like you who can have like an idea of inclusiveness, cooperation, that we certainly didn't have at that time.
I mean, that, yeah, cooperation and compromise, just because of what the Alamo Drafthouse is and what it's become and what it continues to turn into, is a national theater chain, a corporation that has to be managed centrally and operate like a corporation, but with the probably really fabulously unique angle that each market has individual programmers, that there's creative work being done on the ground at each every theater. So in Austin, it's been a matter of navigating that terrain and figuring out what battles to fight, where to concede things in terms of operations and profitability, how much time and effort really needs to be put into stuff that I don't care at all about personally but does have some inherent value, and what really we should completely close the door on and not waste our time with at all. It's something that I continue to learn, and it's going to probably always be an ongoing challenge, just figuring out how to do creative work within the context of a business.
Maybe another challenge also that you're facing, that we're all facing doing this, is how to use the best part of ourselves, and how not to just use ourselves as kind of a workhorse, and how to say no. I mean, it's really essential to say no to those things that are going to be wheel spinning, but ultimately not have that much value. And it's also really necessary to say yes, sometimes even to yourself, about things that are going to present your special gift.
And also, I think just a big part of what I have to spend my days doing is sort of working with community partners and promotional partners, and just feeling out people around town, pursuing them, or reacting to people who reach out to us and just being like, you know, this we can make happen, this we'll get behind, this you just need to go to our private rental department, and sort of spending a lot of time just acting as that sort of community hub for people who want to use our space and use our facilities, and whose, you know, voices and goals we can really help to amplify.
Yeah, we certainly do a lot of that as well, and we'll do even more so now that we have two screens that are going to be opening up later on.
So excited.
Yeah, it is exciting and scary. And exciting and scary. Mm-hmm. But we already do a lot of stuff, but we basically had half a screen. So it's the difference between half a screen and two full screens. That's going to be without really extensively expanding our staff. So,
yeah.
We all got problems. We all got troubles.
This is a very familiar story.
But Holly is here, and she's great, and her programming is great. And I'm here, and I'm so great. And we have a great senior intern program, which you already know a little bit about, because I feel like we have a regular pipeline.
One of them is actually employed very closely side by side with us, and another we are hosting a series that she's programmed and presenting right now. And
that's great. Julie Kipnis, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yep. She's got this series running at the Ritz right now called Loves of a Blonde. I forget exactly what the subtitle is, but it's... golden-haired adolescents in Europe coming of age and sexually exploring. And it's the films are Un Os Amor by Maurice Pilot, Swedish Love Story by Roy Anderson, Lilia Forever. What's that guy's name?
I don't know.
We Are the Best Guy Together.
Yeah, Moodyson.
Moodyson. And then the titular Loves of a Blonde by Miloš Forman.
Mm-hmm.
It's been really well received so far.
Great. That's the kind of series that, like, I feel like if I tried to pull something like that out 5 years ago, Tim would have, like, come into my office and turned purple and looked at me with his head turned sideways.
Mm-hmm. Well, something that's interesting now is the lack of oversight from the highest level in terms of the creative decisions that are going on.
Mm-hmm.
They really put a spectacular amount of trust into us to just oversee and, you know, make it be what it needs to be. Really all we're given are financial goals and then, you know, sort of targets and priorities when it comes to first run and studio relationships and that kind of thing. But beyond that, we're really given free rein to sort of, you know, make it be what we think it should.
And it works. It's like it's hard to explain just how much it pays off with the credibility level that you have, because you have Alamo would be fine without any of that. It would be like Flicks Brewhouse, but it would be fine. Because it would have like all the first run stuff and real clever promotions and real clever, you know, pint glasses or t-shirts or whatever kind of stuff. And that would be great. But like on the sort of highest sort of level with like the cinephiles who really know what's what and who you might see are sort of the alphas in that group, it's like a series like this series you're doing with Julia, it's like it really means a lot. It's like, okay, these are not a bunch of schmoes who just want my wallet. And that's huge. I mean, it's I mean, I don't even know if, like, even executives within the company realize that. I hope they do. I hope they listen to this and realize that. But, like, I think it means a lot for a company to have some stuff of that high level happening.
What really is, like, my bedrock is the colleagues that I have in the other markets. Mm-hmm. The people that Tim has hired to be running the theaters in San Francisco and L.A. and New York and elsewhere are the people at the top of this profession. Mm-hmm. People who I feel, like, frankly, very honored to get to work alongside because they have a lot more experience and wisdom than I do when it comes to any of this.
Christina Cacioppo.
Christina Cacioppo, who did the 92i Tribeca in New mm-hmm. York and has been diligently biding her time and doing the best work possibly imaginable in Yonkers, New York for the last couple of years, waiting for the...
So long, in fact, that I think I'm more or less... I vetted her while I was still at AFS, uh-huh. While I was still at Alamo. So I vetted her in 2012. That's how long she's been waiting for this New York
thing. Yeah, poor Christina.
To really get rolling.
It's a really remarkable that she's stuck it out and is still here and the theater's finally opening. The other people are Mike Keegan in San Francisco, who before this was running the Roxy, and Brett Berg mm-hmm. in Los Angeles. The Los Angeles theater is still a ways off, but he's on our team now, and he, of course, comes from the legendary Cine Family.
And he's running the Pippi Party, or he originated the Pippi Party. Pippi Party.
Yeah.
Which is happening
it's all him.
On June 26th, yeah?
Here in Austin.
Yeah, yes. Yes.
Get your pigtails.
Don't worry. Got my alarm set.
He just did last, or I think maybe Sunday night or something, an original mix show of the best of virtual reality, The Alamo Guide to VR.
Yeah.
I think that about 200 people come out to watch some some disclosure bullshit. Michael Douglas filing files in a filing cabinet in a virtual reality world.
Brett's an incredible example of, and I know him better than I know Christine, and I know him better than I know Mike or any of the other creative managers, but, like, he's a great example of that kind of born programmer who goes down such weird trails. Like, he's, and that's just, not just in film programming. I remember last time he was in Austin, he was reading, like, Irma Bombeck books. And he was excited about Irma Bombeck.
When he came out here to train, probably a year ago at this point, he brought about 12 terabytes worth of hard drives mm-hmm. of just shit that he downloaded off private torrent trackers and stuff, or had ripped himself. And he let me copy it, and this was the best gift I've ever received in my life. His about a decade worth of accumulated ephemera, and just, like, the glimpse that it provides into his brain of what he's gathered up, what he's watched so far, how he's put it in folders, is just like, oh boy, this is an education.
We were talking about, like, prog rock, and he was talking about, like, all these weird prog bands that, like, he's interested, and he's, like, searching on, like, torrent sites for him and stuff, and, like, he figured out that, like, the way to do it is to search for, like, prog rock 1980. not that 1980 was necessarily such a great year, although it was a really interesting year, but then, like, prog rock bands that were still doing stuff in 1980 had probably really been serious about what they were doing, you know? So Brett's really
no
one of those...
No fan writers these.
Yeah, right. So Brett's he's one of those, like, crazy, obsessive, super incredibly smart guys who it's such a credit to a company that you, like, search out a guy like Brett Berg and hire him mm-hmm. and give him power in, like, the second largest city in the United States.
Yeah. Just having the privilege to work alongside him and bounce ideas off of him and, you know, learn from him is unparalleled.
So your day-to-day work is programming, and you've recently kind of made a jump in your job where you had kind of been, like, sort of lead RITS programmer.
Yeah, it was the unusual colloquialism that the Draft House applies to its programmers is creative manager. We all bristle a bit at it, but I had been the creative manager of the RITS and was able to successfully pitch my way into a job titled Austin Programming and Promotions Manager, which is a bit unwieldy, but yeah, I am doing the programming for the whole Austin market now. But the Draft House is interesting in the way that it works, which is a national programming package is created by the director of programming, Sarah, which is then disseminated to all the markets. But the contents of this package are just inherently very populist, very mainstream, not too adventurous, because this stuff has to fly in the markets of, you know, Winchester, Virginia. Although Winchester used to be our punching bag of just like the joke Alamo. The guy, Andy, I don't know exactly how to say his last name, Gurison or something like that, who has been programming there, has done a phenomenal job of building an actual cinephile community in Winchester, Virginia.
I noticed that. Yeah, I did. I looked at the stuff that they were showing there. It was really impressive.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, now we have theaters in Lubbock and El Paso and stuff, and it, you know, maybe they can get build up these cinephile crowds too. But in the meantime, they need to be drawing people in at all. So there is this core programming package that's, you know, just designed to appeal to very broad audiences. So part of it is just facilitating that stuff as it comes through and making sure that, you know, we're keeping happy the people in the suburbs and, you know, trying to really offer as much to as many different crowds and different types of people as we can.
And I just want to, like, go back and clarify for, you know, the TMZ wrap-up of this podcast, that when you said that Winchester was kind of like the joke, that doesn't mean that the theater was a joke. It was just like, if we ever made jokes about, like, oh, this will play great in Winchester, you know, it was like kind of like that's what we meant. It's like,
it's just a very unexpected place to open a draft test. And it was a very early opening when we had just theaters in, like, Austin, Houston, and San Antonio and Winchester, Virginia. It's like, what? Why is this there?
And in the very first part, we would try to sort of translate all kinds of programming to there rather than, you know, just come up with a core, you know, group of sort of syndicated things. So Winchester, Virginia would get things that would never fly, like in a million years in a small, you know, in a Virginia suburb.
Yeah, really trying to fit a square peg into a round hole with a lot of stuff. But yeah, Andy has squared out those edges of that hole.
That's terrific. So so now the big change in what you're doing is that you're looking at the market as a whole and for how to sort of program.
Yeah, and it's interesting. Coming into it, my original instinct was, well, let's spread the cinephile stuff around. Let's really try to get that back very visible, very prominent as sort of a public-facing pillar of the brand. And to some extent, I've realized that that's just not what's needed. It's keeping the Ritz the center of the deep cinephile stuff is good in a lot of ways. One, they only have two screens, and which means we can only have one first run going there at any time. When you book a first run movie, you're committed to giving it a certain number of showings a day. And so if we tried to have two first runs on there, we wouldn't be able to do any specialty programming because we'd be preempting our first run all the time. That means we have a completely open flex screen, which then we have to fill with programming. So there's a necessity just to have things on screen there. So when you start spreading it around too much, then you're having to create additional programming to slot in at Ritz. You start just having way too much on your plate. It's more than you can ever possibly promote. People don't know what's going on, and it falls through the cracks. So yeah, we kind of doubled down on keeping the Ritz the essence of that repertory cinephile stuff. Lamar is really sort of our incubator of smaller indie first run stuff. It's where we really want to find audiences for the smaller movies that aren't just getting like a show, a one-off show. That will usually stick at Ritz, but if we're going to give it a run, we'll put it at Lamar. Then Village, Slaughter, and Lakeline those are more family theaters. We put more blockbuster stuff there. We put more just populist, mainstream, fun, interactive shows, and there's always new shit to figure out. Certain theaters will sag, numbers will be down, and we need to go back, relook at it, rethink what we're doing. The Village is just sort of an endlessly complex puzzle that never quite gets cracked, and we're always hearing from the servers, just like, give us more stuff, give us better stuff, because they want people in there. That's how they make their money. And so it's just this, it's an incredibly complicated balancing act where there's a lot of different priorities: artistic priorities, cultural priorities, financial priorities, just studio obligations that all have to be taken into consideration and really doled out very carefully over the five different venues. And soon we're opening this one right here, right near to the AFS offices where we are at the Mueller Theater, and that's going to be a whole new can of worms. So it's going to, you know, I think that's going to change, along with the Marquesa becoming
AFS Cinema.
AFS Cinemas.
Yeah.
it's going to be another just sort of seismic change of what does the Austin film community look like? Where do certain movies play? What is the role that these different theaters serve the city?
And then recently there's even been like clearances have been struck down, supposedly, although that's
supposedly
tricky. They'll still continue to function.
Yeah, it feels like right now what's going on is the studios are doing a lot of performing for the Justice Department.
Right, right.
And in 6 months it's going to go back.
Exactly. No, I totally agree. Most people don't know what we're talking about, but why get into it? But I think it does. There were always certain restrictions on. A theater could ask for clearances on a title. So, for instance, if they're playing Batman versus Superman, they could say, I don't want that guy that's three blocks away playing Batman versus Superman 2. And if they had the clout, then they could get a clearance. And then they could restrict the other theater from playing Batman versus Superman. So that's supposedly been struck down by the Justice Department, although I suspect it'll keep going. But it's happening at a great time for Alamo, actually, because Alamo has always been kind of a small player and has always been on the wrong side of that kind of stuff. But with Alamo's ascendancy to becoming a much more major player in terms of numbers of screens, and particularly in terms of, you know, loudness of your voice in the national markets, this is really great for you guys because it means that clearances are less likely to affect you.
Yeah, and we're really trying to fight a lot of those battles on the studio terms as well. Mm-hmm. I think what a lot of people just have no idea about is the way that, you know, first-run movies are booked and negotiated. So much of the power, 100% of the power, lies with the studio.
Mm-hmm.
Theaters can ask for things, but there's no guarantee that they'll get them. There's no guarantee that they can get out of anything.
Yeah.
Holdovers are negotiated on a week-by-week basis, so you're constantly trying to inflate grosses on certain titles to prove your worth to distributors, saying, look, we can pull these numbers on these type of movies, give us more bookings, like let us expand this, let us put it at other theaters, while at the same time trying to crush numbers on other bookings. We're like, just get us out of this movie so we can stop having two people in this
house. You didn't say that. That doesn't happen.
No, of course not. Who's the audience of this? I think, like, maybe our pals over at the Audio Assault are going to listen to this.
Yeah, I think, like, Nikki Fink is going to post this on Deadline Hollywood, probably.
Oh, dear. We make sure every movie performs to the best of its ability.
Yeah. But that's the thing, that's a conversation you often find, I would often have with, like, servers. They would be like, can you get us out of this Hansel and Gretel movie on week two or something? You know, it's like, that's actually really not how it works. You know, we might have to ride through 3 weeks of this thing because...
Yeah. At most, you can negotiate a split. So yeah. You have a few shows a day, you can bring on something else and stick...
And then those, like, little bitty houses, which are so helpful for, you know, bringing in small titles, can also be so helpful for getting out of a title that you absolutely positively have to get out of.
Mm-hmm.
It's a tricky... That whole first run side, you know, which I did intensively... is a tricky thing.
It's just like an endless puzzle that never solves itself. You just have to, each week it's sort of looking at it again with fresh eyes and thinking about, you know, balancing money and art. How do you do it?
Mm-hmm.
What does the city want? What do the studios want? What do I want? What is of value for the world and what is of value for these servers who make their living by people coming into these movies?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm afraid the servers, you know, because I really would have like a line, like, I want to show this movie, let's show this movie, it's like important. And sometimes servers would be like, I remember a server one time saying, what was that Dave Chappelle, like, stoner movie?
Half-Baked.
Yeah, I remember one time a stoner saying, like, I don't remember what we were playing, like some Johnny Toe movie or something, and she was just like, hey man, I just wanted to, like, have you ever thought about playing some stuff that would get, like, more people, like, Half-Baked? It was like... In her world, like, that would absolutely, you know, Half-Baked would be the way to go, you know? I didn't think Half-Baked was exactly the right way that I wanted to take, you know, Wednesday night, 7 o'clock at the Ritz, you know?
I think we did run it 420 this year.
Probably, yeah.
Why not?
No criticism of running that at 420, certainly.
Yeah, it's hard communicating that down to the servers so that they understand there's a lot of animosity that can build up when your livelihood is being affected by us choosing to show some arty thing that...
Especially if they think you're just some, like, dilettante, you know, who's prancing in and out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, there's issues of trust and just understanding on our part of making sure that we're taking care of them. And it's... yet another thing. It's just a constant, ongoing negotiation of principle and necessity.
If I ever had a chance to, like, you know, move chairs or, like do anything to help out, I would just be sure that I was jumping in and doing it.
I'd bounce the second I can get out of there.
Do you?
No. I don't know.
I want them to see that, like, we're all on the same team, you know. It's like, just genuinely.
There are so many servers who have been there for years and years and years and who are really devoted to the idea of the Alamo and to showing their movies.
Absolutely.
They are definitely unsung heroes.
Oh, incredible people.
Who you can support by tipping.
Yeah, absolutely. Do people not tip?
I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. They should. You should tip when you go to the Alamo. So, it's funny. I've got our joint calendars printed out here that I'm looking at. It's funny because we would sometimes, you and I would, sometimes in months past, go through and try to make sure that we weren't programming against one another. We no longer really do that so much.
I think the volume of worthwhile programming that we're both putting out,
it's hard to do.
It's hard to do, but it also increasingly doesn't matter as much because the number of people attending shows in Austin continues to grow.
Yeah, it's been great. And I think the best thing, though, you know, you're not always going to be able to avoid it, but there are going to be things like the Ida Lupino series where we're showing stuff like one day only. Mm-hmm. And like that's mostly Thursday nights, which is great because it really doesn't conflict that much with stuff you guys are usually doing Thursday nights.
Yeah, I mean, Draft House definitely concentrates its cinephile stuff Sunday through Wednesday and sort of clears out Thursday through Saturday for the most profitable,
mm-hmm.
which is not ever the most cinephile.
And then we'll try to do things, AFS will try to do things like do two screenings, like a movie like The Other Side, which we're playing tonight, the new Roberto Minervini,
mm-hmm.
try to do that a couple of times so that we're, you know, while we may be, you guys are playing Once Upon a Time in the West tonight,
mm-hmm.
There's certainly going to be overlap in that, but then hopefully it won't be an overlap on our next showing on Tuesday. Although there but you know,
but
it's just, you can't help it.
You got to make your choices. You can go to the movies every night of the week and you still can't see everything.
Some people do, and I think that sometimes we kind of tend to make choices for those people who go to the movies, you know, seven nights a week. But that's not most people,
mm-hmm.
you know. And like if we hear from somebody, we might hear from Neil Wilson or like Zach McGee or somebody, or you know, about like, oh, I wish I can't make this and this and this. It's like, well, we're trying.
Those are the breaks.
Those are the breaks.
What a horrible problem you have.
Yeah, right.
But yeah, let me just say, as far as the showing Once Upon a Time in the West, it seems like a very out of nowhere, just sort of random pick. But it's each month at the Ritz, we let the employee of the month choose a staff pick.
Uh-huh.
So it's just sort of a way to keep people excited and engaged. So Spencer, the bartender, shout out. Thanks for picking a good movie.
Yeah, great movie. Although not Leone's best, but that's an argument we can have at another time.
All right, let's say it on the count of three. One, two, three.
For a few dollars more.
High five.
Yeah, all right. Actually, Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, and For a Few Dollars More are kind of tied for me, but that's funny we both thought that.
I think it's an increasingly prevalent opinion.
Is it?
Amongst this crowd.
Would you call it a crowd?
Two's a crowd?
That's interesting, yeah. Because that was like the orthodoxy was Once Upon a Time in America was that's obviously Leone's best.
West.
Once Upon a Time in the West, yeah, obviously Leone's best. And then, I think it's For a Few Dollars More, Good, the Bad, anyway. Mm-hmm. Nobody thinks it's Fistful of Dollars or DocuSucker. I think you know what I think is coming on is Once Upon a Time in America will come on and maybe be.
I don't know, that movie's too riddled with like weird problematic stuff that makes you feel some kind of way to ever like just be that joy that the dollar stuff is.
Yeah, it's not a joy. There's a scene that I think we're both thinking about that is not a joy.
No.
That is pretty tough to take, but it's a movie that feels gigantic in scope. And if you ever get a chance to see it on the big screen, it's like you got to do it.
Mm-hmm.
It's so incredibly beautiful. But I wanted to talk about some of the stuff that you guys have coming up because the De Palma series.
Yeah.
When does that start? That starts
Monday.
Monday, yeah. So that's coming up.
Yeah, we're doing, I think, 13 of his older films, concentrating really just on the thriller end of things.
Mm-hmm.
No Wise Guys.
No Casualties of War.
No, although that is a great movie.
Yeah, it
really
is.
Really considered putting it in there, but ultimately there's just not that much space. But yeah, of course, occasioned by the new documentary that's coming out. I think we're far from the only place doing a De Palma retrospective right now. It's sort of a hot ticket in pretty much every city.
Like Metrograph or somebody's doing it, yeah.
But it's good. It's something, you know, just sort of been on a list of something to get around to at some point. I don't think it's really too adventurous of a programming choice this day and age, but getting the chance to revisit those on the big screen is good.
It's not cutting edge, but that's an interesting sort of thing about programming. It's like, it's really not about the drama of the programmer, you know? It's not, like, what we're doing is not like, oh, the programmer has, it's not programmer, programmer, programmer. It's like audience. Like, a lot of the audience has, you know, outside of us, has probably never really stopped and considered all these weird little things that make Brian De Palma's film so unusual and so good.
Well, I think, you know, there definitely is a goal in programming to break orthodoxy and to sort of bring underappreciated things to light. But with Brian De Palma, really, the age of that now is about 15 to 20 years ago. Because as a filmmaker, his body of work is so inextricably linked to the critical discourse around it and to just the public response to it that he was so maligned and so reactionary to that really so many of his movies are sort of direct provocations of critics. Someone like Pauline Kael, who's really his most noted champion, was her credibility as a critic was brought into question because she was so appreciative of his work. And, you know, around the time of, I don't know, I guess probably that sort of post-Mission to Mars era, certain people, lunatics like Armand White among them, really just sort of hammered home that Brian De Palma is a significant filmmaker, you know, both drawing out the just the fact that he comes from that movie brat school of Scorsese, Coppola, Spielberg, Lucas, that he is of that, but then went so far outside of that in terms of you know, his relationship with an audience and popular filmmaking and commercial filmmaking. He's really sort of the renegade of that crew. And now I think, you know, anyone who knows film, talks film, has some sense of Brian De Palma, isn't just like, oh, I know Scarface, I know Carrie, whatever. I think people really do understand him to be a major auteur.
And that is, like you said, fairly new. Like, relatively new in the sweep of film history.
But established enough at this point that doing a Brian De Palma retrospective doesn't feel dangerous or provocative. It's really, it's become populist.
Yeah, it's one of those things, like, where I kind of looked at it and I was like, my first thought was like, well, I've always kind of looked at that and I was like, that won't, like, a De Palma retrospective just won't draw, you know, and I've talked to you about that. Like, I don't think that's true so much, because I think things have changed and it's like, it has moved kind of more into the mainstream of the market, and I think it will draw. But it was kind of like, yeah, it feels a little played, but it's not. It's like, it's just that I'm not, it would be like if somebody came up to me and started talking to me about, like, David Foster Wallace, I'd be like, ugh, I'd be rolling my eyes, you know, I'd be like, yeah, everybody knows. It's kind of like that with, like, De Palma. It's like, everybody knows, but, like, that's one thing. That's us theoretically talking. But then also people are going to sit down in a cinema and they're going to watch Obsession.
Yeah, and I mean, I think that everybody knows thing is a pitfall, too, that you can fall into. It's the other side of that breaking the orthodoxy, you know, reclaiming malign things.
Totally.
It's that you overlook the things that are just good to see in a theater. Once Upon a Time in the West. I wouldn't have thought to put that on a calendar. But you show that movie and you remember that it's one of the best movies. Like, that's unimpeachably good.
And you think about the experiences you've had watching that in a theater. Uh-huh. Who's going to make that happen?
Yeah.
For like, today's 22-year-old.
Yeah, absolutely. And I remember the first time seeing any of those Leones in the theater was around the time that Good and the Bad and the Ugly restoration came out.
The one with the new scene added?
Who cares about that? Oh. But in Seattle, it was an unseasonably hot day, and the Grand Illusion Cinema near a Scarecrow Video was showing Fistful and A Few Dollars More, and the AC was out, and so I just watched. It was me and Joel Fisher, and I think that was about it. We were in there, took our shoes off, sweating profusely, just watching those movies. It was like, yeah, it was one of the great movie going experiences.
Magic moment. So, and everybody, of course, knows that the best Brian De Palma movie is, on the count of three, two, one, Phantom of the Paradise.
Oh, I didn't think about it. No, I would say it's hard to argue against that one. I would probably go with The Fury.
Yeah, I would have said that. That really would have been the one I would have said. My mouth could have gone either direction on that. I love The Fury.
The Fury is like the first one where it all comes together.
Yeah.
Something like Phantom of the Paradise I don't know. Describe Phantom of the Paradise.
Just this incredibly weird kind of... This sort of transmutation of like the silent pulp aesthetic into the freak rock 70s age.
Mm-hmm. Sure. That's as good a description as any. Now describe The Fury.
The Fury, I would say, would be a delirious expression of post-60s paranoia as filtered through movie star consciousness.
Yeah, absolutely. That nails it.
Is it really?
I don't know. It's the one where just the craft of it becomes so...
Like the train set.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like inescapably magnetic. That there's no way not to just get played by that movie every time you watch it. Not to get swept up in just the way it provokes you and fucks with you. And then it's weird post-Hollywood, post-New Hollywood filtering of like what is a movie, how do you relate to these stars on screen.
It has this real, in a way it's kind of like the negation of New Hollywood in a strange sort of way. I mean, in a big way kind of, because like it's like the star of the movie is old Hollywood, and then I guess in the course of the movie, they kind of blow up John Cassavetes. That's about the most literal way that you could say, okay, this is the destruction of this fucking New Hollywood shit that I was never on board with, and here's old Hollywood, the triumph of old Hollywood.
Yeah, and I think De Palma really asks you to read his movies on those levels.
You think so, yeah.
Yeah, it's...
It's gotta be.
He's in constant dialogue with a sort of critical community, and it's... you know, intertextual play.
It would be interesting if, like, he blew up, if he also blew up, like, Michael Cimino, and if, like, he just, like, had a whole bunch of guys that he blew up that all represented the New Hollywood. Mm-hmm. Or, like, the new filmmaking. But that De Palma series is, like, it's actually really exciting when you think about it. And, I wish when... it's weird that I sometimes think about, like, oh, 22-year-olds or 24-year-olds. It's like, I'd be so excited to be a 24-year-old living in Austin right now, like, and with a chance to see, like, all this kind of stuff. To, like, on one night, to be able to go see Phantom of the Paradise and then follow that up with, you know, Dr. Caligari.
That's the other thing about how these Ritz calendars shake out. There's not just, like, a series going. There's always something in the late round, and there's always some other weird thing where it's just, like, stick around, and you're going to get the most amazing whiplash.
Yeah, no, it's true. Like... Look, that's not even an intentional double feature, Phantom of the Paradise and Dr. Caligari. But
how well do those movies complement each other?
Great.
They speak to each other.
Yeah,
I mean, and that's what happens when you start watching movies en masse, is that the movies begin to talk to each other, and you see connections, you find these, like, weird pathways, like, behind reality that, on this metaphysical level, make this tapestry of movies where they're all, I don't know, these movies dreaming of each other, movies dreaming of movies, and you get to live there. It's a beautiful thing.
How's this for like a few days of film going? So you're at Ritz for watching Lilia Forever, and I don't know what the Terror Tuesday is that night. It cuts off on my calendar, whatever that is next week, the Terror Tuesday. Begins with a T.
I think that's Slumber Party Massacre, maybe.
Okay. So you're watching that, and then the next night you watch Phantom of the Paradise, Dr. Caligari double feature at Ritz, and then you're at AFS Theater watching Anime Wong in Piccadilly.
Oh my God.
And then you're watching Beauty and the Beast, Jean Cocteau's Beauty and the Beast, newly restored at 35mm at AFS Cinema, and Edward Yang's Brighter Summer Day.
Who knows what's going on at the Paramount?
And then The Labyrinth is playing that. I didn't print out the Paramount schedule, but there'll be also amazing things then too. And then you've got like this Cinema Sirens and Video Vortex stuff.
Yeah, it's it's a golden age, I think.
This is a golden summer, like, in a lot of ways, I think. I had posted that at one point, and it's like, I really think that that's true. Like, with all the stuff that's coming up and having a chance to see this stuff back to back to back. And I should have put it at the Paramount schedule, too, because, like, that's amazing. I want to talk to Steven about some of that stuff on this podcast coming up as well, because that's, I don't know how many people have had that experience of being able to go see movies at the Paramount, but you should. Summertime, Paramount, oh, beautiful.
And he, you know, I think very transparently has to negotiate those same constructs of accessibility and expectation and, you know, what the organization is asking of him and what the community that really supports the Paramount wants versus, you know, sort of what's required. Like, what do the screens need? And it's something...
Yeah, I don't want to speak for his challenge, but, like, but if I were to look at that, I would be like, that's actually, like, a pretty enormous challenge to, like, have this sort of historical theater and then a program for that in a way that's going to get audiences, is going to feel true.
This is 2,000 seats or something.
Yeah, it's enormous.
It's a completely different battle than filling a 75 seats or 180 seats or something.
Yeah, and it's you want people to come and have fun and come year after year, but then you also want to try to work in some other stuff and some sort of new classics, some newly minted classics in a way, like things that we're taking a fresh look at. Like right now, like a movie like Halsu or something has kind of become like a classic along the lines of like Casablanca or something.
Yeah, it's weird how fast that stuff can become orthodox, orthodized, or I don't know what.
Like 10 years ago, if you heard a theater was playing Possession, you'd be like, "Oh my god, they're playing Jaworski's Possession! This is amazing! I don't care. I'm taking the week off work, you know." But now, if you heard a theater's playing Possession, you just feel like, "Ugh, so easy."
But thinking just about this Austin landscape right now, there's so many other organizations out there, too, that don't have a dedicated space who are doing great things. There's Experimental Response Cinema and Cinema East.
Who do quite a lot of stuff here in this very space we're recording this podcast.
And in our theaters as well.
Tommy, I got to say, like, looking at the programming that you do, I think that I can really see a lot of sort of your social consciousness there. And a lot of the social consciousness that... is part of the Austin scene at large. Like, how do you feel that, like, that your social and political consciousness affects your programming?
I think it has a huge influence on what I do, and I feel that I often don't rise to the challenge of what I should be doing. The film programming world, the Alamo Drafthouse specifically, are very white male dominated fields. There's not a lot of diverse voices happening. You know, it's systemic problem in filmmaking in general, from production through really every level, and it's imperative that people with any amount of power are very actively fighting against that and doing as much as we can to put work of minority filmmakers and, you know, get women and people of color and queer trans people, just get that visibility, get it out there, get it on screens, and get audiences coming to see that stuff. Because the more that those sorts of films and art and, you know, culture can really start being seen by wide groups of people, I think the more it can sort of actually justify being financed. And it's, of course, a very rigged and unfair system, but, you know, being in the role of a film programmer affords the opportunity to at least support those films in some way. I sometimes think that, you know, really the best thing I could do as a film programmer would just be to quit and hire someone else in my place. And, you know, it's really hard to argue against that. It's probably true. But, you know, for now I'm still here. But, yeah, I do really feel in a profound obligation to, you know, I think diversity is a loaded word, but, you know, amplify the voices of marginalized artists.
Yeah, I think that that's really necessary and important to look at. It's a thing that, you know, it's an accident of birth that we happen to be white males, but it's not an accident that we're in our positions, you know, and that our whiteness and our maleness has helped us to be in this position. It's like, I don't think that there's any, I think we'd be fooling ourselves, and I don't think we're inclined to fool ourselves, that, like, when a white man walks in and starts talking, you know, it has a different effect on people who do hiring, et cetera. You know, it's like we have been so privileged to be able to have a chance to do this job, and we have to be conscious of it to understand.
Yeah, I was allowed to learn on the job. I mean, I knew movies, but I there's no way to learn this work ahead of time. It has to be done on the job, and so you need to be given an opportunity. And the people that are given opportunities are white, straight males. And it's, you know, it's imperative that the people who have the ability to do hiring and to bring other people into the fold really very consciously, very deliberately make an effort to do it.
And by and large, as we move forward, we're going to have those opportunities to bring more people in the fold. And I think that that's where we have to have this sort of consciousness of how it happens and how people enter that.
And not approaching it from any sense of authority or wisdom, really being open to letting other people guide it, letting them make the decisions, make the creative choices, do what feels right, and just get out of the way.
It's funny, when I was first, and this is some real talk here, but when I was first like looking at movies, looking at repertory movies, maybe 22, 23 years ago, when I lived in New York, and I would look at what was playing, sometimes I would see like Black filmmaker series. I was like, oh, this is like, what is this? And this is me at a much earlier point of my consciousness. I would say, oh, this is this politically correct thing. I wouldn't say it out loud, but I would say it in my head. I was like, so now they're going to put these films by these Black female filmmakers, and I could be watching the films of Jean Renoir right now. You know, mm-hmm. It's like, and I would like look at that as kind of like, why is this politically correct programming here? But as I became more of a human being and like opened my eyes and began to listen and talk to other people and like become a human being, it's like I realized that this is not just something that's like where this Black filmmaker series was there to be like politically correct or to get a grant or something like that. It's like by watching this, it's like it changed my mind. So it made me not be that person who had been such a dumbass in those years.
Yeah, I mean, let me posit that it wasn't you who necessitated that development in yourself. It was the work of
right.
people of color.
Exactly.
It was the work of women
exactly.
who forced you to change your opinion
right.
on that.
Who grew me out of my baby brain, you know, that made me appreciate that. And if those programs hadn't existed, then I'd just be this idiot, you know?
We're still idiots.
We're still idiots, but we know it, you know. this is some pretty deep talk from a couple of white guys, but it's like, you know, it's a thing that we think about. I have so many opportunities working with our interns and our senior interns to find people that to help people in their careers and to give them whatever lessons that I've learned, and that for me is like one of the biggest parts. It's not just helping these young people who will someday maybe might want to be like driving a Mercedes in Hollywood, mm-hmm. but to help these young people who might someday want to make a film and to give them whatever kind of life lessons that I've picked up by having been such a total dumbass but with open eyes and open ears all those years.
Yeah.
So after you're doing your diploma series, tell me about that series, because that's a really exciting one that you're doing.
So this is one of my dream series. This is something that from day one, when someone suggested that you could program films, this is something that I wanted to do. And it's taken till now to really build the confidence and, you know, the expectation that anyone will show up to see it. But the series is called Super Crime with a K, the World of Pulp Supervillains. And it's by far the biggest in scope series that I've attempted. And it's fairly esoteric as far as these things go. But it's spanning really the entire history of filmmaking, focusing on these really pulp supervillains.
Mm-hmm.
So we begin the furthest back with the work of Louis Fouillade and his films Fantomas and Les Vampires. And we trace the lineage that stuff creates all the way through up to Christopher Nolan, Dark Knight. So along the way we get Fritz Lang's Mabuza movies, we get some Fu Manchu, we get the Rathbone Sherlock Holmes with Moriarty and the Spider-Woman.
Of course, Franju.
To my deep sadness, we have not been able to procure Nuit Rouge, Shadow Man, but we are doing Judex.
That's too bad, because there was that print that was on MGM's list of Shadow Man.
I know.
It's gone.
It doesn't exist.
All gone, okay, all right.
Uh-huh.
That's too bad.
And the archives who have unsubtitled Nuit Rouge movies aren't loaning them.
Yeah.
To bring the conversation a bit full circle, we're doing some Edgar Wallace Creamy movies,
mm-hmm.
which I'm smuggling out of a film archive in Vienna thanks
wow.
to a guy who's, who's doing a personal loan to himself of these movies and having the faith to ship them to us. They're also unsubtitled, so we're going to have to do live soft subbing on these. It's going to be an adventure. But, yeah, this is a real holy grail.
That's amazing.
Of just an absolute indulgence. This is a series that is not made for an audience. There's a lot of what I do that's, you know, trying to cater to other people's tastes and to make people happy. This is just undeniably a series to make me happy. But I think that my love and appreciation for this is so deep.
You know, there's enough high points. I mean, it's a great series, and people are going to love it. But there's enough things that are going to keep everybody happy.
Like, absolutely. We've got James Bond movies. Yeah. We've got Diabolic. Yeah. Inter-Diabolic. We've got...
Which you're running on the same night that I'm showing Moontide, which bumps me out a lot.
That's too big of a conflict to ignore. Let's fix that.
I can't. That's the only date I can have that.
I can fix that.
Okay. Because have you seen Moontide?
Oh, it's a masterpiece. Oh, it's incredible.
So good.
I want to come see Moontide.
Yeah, yeah. 35.
Oh, okay. We're moving Diabolical.
Okay, good. Something good has happened with this podcast.
You've got the list there. What am I...
Okay, let's see. Yeah, you guys have... Yeah, Alabama's Ghost is not part of that, but it could be. Wait a minute.
Belphegor,
the Bat Whispers.
TV. Oh, the Bat Whispers.
Yeah,
the,
yeah.
It's the 35mm reduction of the 65mm version. It's a very early sound film that... famously a huge inspiration on Batman.
Yeah, yeah.
But that is just a wonder to behold. It's the level of production design that goes
I've never seen it, but I have seen Shandu the Magician.
Ah, yes, on a double bill with The Spider. That's our William Cameron Menzies double feature.
That's great.
Yeah. So if listeners are familiar with William Cameron Menzies, he's primarily an art director, although he directed things as well, and, you know, very famously worked on prestige pictures like Gone with the Wind and stuff like that, but began working in the silent era, and it's difficult to describe a Menzies trademark, but if you were to put enough still frames side by side, you'd get an absolute sense of the way that he uses space and vertical space and, you know, big sweeping lines, and he's able to do it with sets, with architecture, and with the human face as well. He just has a very, very distinct sense of design and of how things look.
And of lighting, like lighting for his sets and using miniatures in a way that you kind of know that you're looking at miniatures and you're looking at special effects and double exposures, but you kind of don't care. Like in the same way that you know that Ray Harryhausen movies are, you know, little clay figures, but you kind
of
don't care because
it becomes
magic. It becomes actually transfigured magic before your eyes. That's kind of the magic of Menzies. And then you're doing... Which Sherlock Holmes movies are you doing?
Adventures Of, which is the one with Moriarty, and Spider-Woman, which is my favorite.
Yeah, that's the best. Gail Sondergaard and Angela Rizzuto. I love that stuff. So people
and
who are...
UCLA is so great to have preserved those movies.
I didn't know they had.
Yeah, it's remarkable.
And Universal owns the rights on those too, so that's super easy. Why are you guys doing Boom Secret Ceremony, or is that a secret?
That's a completely separate thing from this, but you'll see this. Well, you can't see the way this is printed.
Okay.
But, Millie DeChirico from Turner Classic Movies, Turner Midnights or whatever that series is, she's coming in to do a little 3-day residency of something pretty similar to the territory covered by Kayla's book House of Psychotic Women. But, Boom Secret Ceremony double feature, which is, of course, the Joseph Losey, Elizabeth Taylor, Insanity. That Terror Tuesday is Criminally Insane, a.k.a.
Crazy Fat Ethel.
And the Weird Wednesday is...
Good Luck, Miss Wyckoff.
Good Luck, Miss Wyckoff, a.k.a. The Sin, which no print of the Good Luck, Miss Wyckoff is available, but Vinegar Syndrome has the first 3 reels, and UNCSA has The Sin. So we're borrowing both of those and making a composite that hopefully... You know, most of what's cut from The Sin is in the early reels.
Okay,
so
that's
I think
good.
It'll be a fairly good approximation of that movie.
Nobody's doing programming like this. By the way, Boom Secret Ceremony, that double feature, you're talking about Kayla Janice's book, she programmed that for that exact same double feature for AFS, like in 2003 or something. So that's a very, that's a very Kayla Janice night.
Time is a flat circle.
It is, yeah. And I will hazard that probably most people in our viewing audience were not there in 2003.
No.
So that, but that's
another thing that's exciting about Austin is that there's, I mean, it's what's killing it, but it's also what's fueling it, is that there's so many people coming here, new people,
yeah.
Things that you think are tired, people haven't seen them, and there's just always this chance to bring it out again. But I mean, you have to do it in moderation, so you're not just on a 2-year rinse and repeat cycle.
It's definitely a thing that we've got to keep at front of mind, because I don't keep it at front of mind often enough that, like, I feel like, oh yeah, we just showed, I don't know, Husbands, you know, mm-hmm. 3 years ago. It's like, well, but there's a whole new class, you know?
Yeah, I mean, you're showing Scarlet Empress in a couple weeks.
And you guys just showed that 2 years ago.
Yeah, we did that Dietrich von Sternberg mm-hmm. thing, and there was a lot of people at our show. There's going to be even more people at your show.
Mm-hmm. Who, like, finally have that chance to see it. It's also a weird thing that it freaks me out a little bit that there are so many people who are, like, Alamo-only people, or that are, like, AFS-only people, and that they don't really seem all that knowledgeable about the different things that are going on. I don't think there's a lot of those people, but there's definitely people like that who I don't think...
I understand the AFS-only people more just because the sheer volume that the Alamo does makes it kind of difficult to track our calendar.
Mm-hmm.
We don't... I mean, you guys, you do lock your calendars. You put out 2-month blocks at a time, and it's discrete, and you have a print calendar, and mm-hmm. it's clear. Whereas ours is just, it never locks. It's always rolling, and there's so much to sift through that it really is a challenge. And the fact that...
And you got so many things to promote.
As much sticks to the wall as does is a goddamn miracle.
Like, you guys, like, in order to promote... And I remember I would have those meetings, we'd have promotional meetings where we'd have promotional priorities. You guys probably don't still do that, but we'd have, like, a promotional...
Oh, we do still do that.
You do still do that, okay. I invented that. I want that to be called the Lars Nils Memorial Promotional Priorities. But where we'd have, like, 4 promotional priorities, and you would hack it out in our Monday meeting to be like, no, the sing-along's going to be fine. We don't need to drive people to that sing-along. We need to drive people to, you know, to this the pee-pee party. You know, it's like, and have those kinds of things. But it was always such a fight because, like, the stuff that really makes money is, like, the sing-alongs or the master pancake or whatever.
Yeah, and it is a fight, and it's just... You know, this is a point that I keep returning to, but it's compromise and balance, where you can't stop fueling the bankroll stuff. You have it; nothing self-sustains. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of magical thinking that goes in where it's like, well, this is set. Terror Tuesday just works. Mm-hmm. It sells out every week. Mm-hmm. It's fine. No, it sells out every week because Joe endlessly puts effort into it.
Yeah.
And it's that sort of thing where it's like, nothing can work if you don't promote it. Certain things have more appeal than others. Where's that balance? How can you even get all of this information across? There's, you know, well, I don't even know how many screens there are, 30-something in Austin. It's too much. But it works somehow. It feels fragile, to be honest. It feels like it could just snap at any moment.
Here's how fragile it is. It's like Weird Wednesday sold out every week forever. And it just sold out constantly. And Terror Thursday, which later became Terror Tuesday, was kind of like the little brother of it. Once I became, like, the market sort of manager, it's like I kind of treated Weird Wednesday like the coach would treat his son who's on the team in a way. Mm-hmm. It's like kind of like, yeah, no, I'm not looking for any kind of special promotion on this thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then it became like kind of a thing where, like, people didn't show up to it as much, you know, because I was just like, no, we don't give that any promotion. It doesn't need promotion. It's fine for whatever it is. But, like, that was an example of just how fragile that was. It's like Weird Wednesday went from being, like, the thing that sold out every week to the thing where, like, you know, there'd be, like, 70 people there. You know, I remember, like, sometimes we wouldn't break 100, and it was like, what?
Mm-hmm.
Didn't break 100? So, like, that, all that kind of stuff, like, the stuff, like, being able to actually promote the stuff is, I mean, it's
and
huge.
It's easy for us to lump Terror Tuesday and Weird Wednesday together because they're both midweek late night series that sell for $3 and it's 35mm genre movies. But the instant hook of a horror movie
mm-hmm.
versus the impossible to nail down nebulousness of
what is this,
like, exploitation plus is just like,
I remember showing Joe Sarno's Butterflies one time, and, like, the feedback, like, we got a complaint email that, like, that wasn't even weird, it was just like a porno. It's like, yeah, people
those
are
Joe Sarno movies are so mainstream.
Yeah, they're so main. Butterflies was so mainstream. Yeah, no, it's always tricky to promote, and this is, I'm speaking as someone who has overstepped my promotion on Surrealist Love Goddesses this week, so I'm like, I realize that I've taken it just a step too far of, like, being a little bit in everybody's face about it. But it's, you know, it's either that take a risk of over promoting a thing or under promoting things and then not having the audience actually ever hear about them, really.
Mm-hmm. But then even they still happen and there's still 20 people there and you're like, wow, this was this in and of itself is a magical thing.
If there are 20 people at Surrealist Love Goddesses, I will put a bullet in my brain. Obviously.
Well, it's you know, if there's 20 people at
the Bat Whispers.
No, we need a better crowd on that. If there's 20 people at... We need more than 20 people at every show.
Yeah, no, but, we need at least 40 people at every show.
Know,
if there's 20 people at Alabama's Ghost, then you're happy.
I think Frederick Hobbs is marquee draw.
It's the weirdest movie I've ever seen, I'll tell you that much. Well, anyway, so now we're just looking at papers while the tape recorder runs. So Tommy, thanks for coming over and talking about this stuff. It's a weird thing because we just kind of had a conversation, and I think, oh well, this has no interest to anybody. But I guarantee you, people will be listening to this and they'll be interested in these kinds of things. People love hearing about.
We could
go
for another few hours.
If we were to go for another few hours, and we could, you're right. I couldn't go for that much longer in this space, but I would want to talk about the pulp. Imagination, and I would want to talk about the pulp impulse.
Let's talk about that a little bit before we cut off. I don't know if I'll have another opportunity to do it in this sort of context.
It's a thing that I need to have conversations about because I've never really quite refined what I love about the pulp impulse.
That's very similar for me. I don't. If this series was to start right now, I'd feel very ill prepared to actually, you know, go talk about these movies, but. They're some of the stuff that really I just love the most on the cellular level. And what is it? What draws that? I think with the super crime stuff, it's easier to define than some of the more nebulous, you know, adventure mystery kind of thing. Because it has this element of crime, but not just crime, super crime.
Right.
What is that? What the hell is that? There's so many great just sort of descriptors of like Fantomas is the genius of crime. Not a genius, but the genius of crime. And Moriarty is the Napoleon of crime. And there's just something so inherently appealing about this idea of crime.
Well, let's trace back the idea of crime. I mean, we could trace it back to early childhood traumas, you know, probably. I mean, there's readings of like what... crime, the apprehension of criminals, of what all that means that's, you know, psychoanalytical. But also, let's look back at, like, where did super crime literature start? Because it certainly started as literature.
And crime is a lot like comedy because it's only valuable when it's punching up. The crime that punches down is, you know, crime where the victim is an individual, a person. Mm-hmm. They're being... violated in some way or another, whereas punching up crime is against establishment, against state, against status quo, and I think, you know, that's a huge part of it. But yeah, where does it begin? It begins in this pulp literature, and I think particularly in France with the work of Marcel Alain and Fantomas and then just sort of the atomic impact and rippling effect that stuff had.
Were there not super criminals in literature prior to Fantomas? And that was serialized, I imagine, right? Were those serialized novels?
In a sense, it's a series, but there's not cliffhangers, they're discrete narratives.
Was it serialized in the popular press, or was it serialized as novels or chapter books?
To be honest, I don't know France. Mm-hmm. You know, obviously in America, the pulps were in magazines and often serialized, or in newspapers, and, you know, you work like... What do you have something in mind earlier than Fantomas that really?
I haven't prepared to even think about this or even to timeline this out, nor could I even really tell you exactly when Fantomas was published or when The Shadow was published or when, you know, I mean, I have a general idea. I know Fantomas was before all that kind of stuff, but I'm not sure what was being published in like England.
The amount of passion you can have for something like this without actually having that base of knowledge, but. Yeah, I mean, in Jules Verne, you have, you know, really Nemo or Robur. Those are super criminals.
Mm-hmm.
It is inherently tied to the rise of modernity, the modern age, the industrial society, that there becomes this sort of level of state control through capitalist endeavor that becomes oppressive and sort of cries out for this transgressive figure. I think that's something in the root of it. I don't know.
A transgressive individualist.
Yeah, well, and then it's interesting to think, there's no structure to what we're talking about right here, but to look at the different ways that these characters manifest, because Fantômas is this disembodied boogeyman type of guy who's infinitely disguised and can appear anywhere and can strike terror into the heart of this bourgeois society, and he really is sort of disrupting the status quo and turning the modern city into this like boiling cauldron of upset, and you know, really embodied in the Fouillade movies, where they give you this just sort of shiver of unreality and lean towards this surrealist impulse of just the unexpectedly horrific manifesting at any moment into regular existence. Then you have something like Mabuza, which is just so clearly the power of the state embodied in one figure. Where, you know, it's no unique insight to tie it directly to Nazism, because
yeah, and significantly that's why Fritz Lang had to leave Germany.
The Testament of Dr. Mabuza is a very bravely political statement against fascism, but at the same time it's escapist pulp. It's this menacing figure in a room controlling the world and managing your fates. And you see it in his other stuff too, as early as The Spiders, and very present in Spies, these sort of all-powerful cabals running things behind the scenes.
I think when we talk about the pulp impulse, there's more to it than supervillains, although that's part of what we're doing, part of obviously what we're talking about on this podcast. But I think that there's something about the world in which pulp exists that's close to the unconscious. And you know my theory, I think I've shared before, is like that the people who are writing pulp stories and pulp novels were doing so at such high volume and around the clock that like the dream state intruded into their typewriter, basically.
Yeah,
so that
absolutely.
Like they were writing so close to the unconscious because they were so exhausted and so worn out and so shorn of you know, conscious ideas that this unconsciousness kind of came into it. And it, and that is what it, it's interesting we have such a difficult time, we're articulate people, we have such a difficult time articulating what we love about pulp just in this conversation. And I feel like even if I prepared, I would still have a hard time really talking about what I love about pulp. But I know that you, it's almost like I look at you, I look at Laird, and a few other people I know as people that kind of really get pulp in a way that I don't know that I feel like everybody quite gets what it is about pulp.
I wonder if it's just like some sort of inborn ability, like tasting cilantro as soap, where it's just like you can't like this or it's delicious.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know, because there aren't like formative early childhood things where it locked me into it. It's just there's something there.
Yeah, there's some labyrinthine sort of unconscious thing about.
And I mean, it was so quickly embraced by surrealists, you know, especially in cinema, but in other places too. But you just look at a film like The Pearl or Monsieur Fantômas, where it's very deliberately evoking the Fouillade stuff and filtering it through in a very explicitly surreal point of view. That speaks volumes, I think, for what lies there at the heart of the pulp. And that like dreams into the typewriter type of thing can be, you know, so clearly seen in the more extreme ends of stuff, like a Harry Stephen Keeler novel that really feels like a transcription of a dream.
Yeah, I haven't read it. I haven't read any of his stuff.
Oh, you've got to.
Yeah.
The Riddle of the Traveling Skulls is the one that you can probably get your hands on the easiest. McSweeney's reprinted that at some point. The others are frustratingly expensive. But, yeah, he'll have sentences that last two pages and character names that are unpronounceable and, you know, plot resolutions that happen on the final page. He'll put in those guess the solution page breaks, and you think about it, and then you read the solution, and there's genuinely no preparation. Like, a character gets introduced on the page before that who is, in fact, the culprit. It's just, what is this?
It's a guess the solution that you could not have ever worked, done the math and worked your way to.
The Mystery of the Fiddling Cracksman is about a criminal who breaks into banks so he can play the fiddle for money. Not for money, to money. He goes in there at night and plays the fiddle to the money.
That's great.
But then there's these weird currents where these series of books have these interlocking things where they're not, you know, it's not a Doc Savage, not a Shadow, where it's a series, but there's strange recurring characters and situations and echoes. And it does, a lot of pulp has that Borgesian, you know, metaphysical, unanswerable mystery at the heart of it, that these things are just endlessly elliptical and sort of fold back in on themselves.
Yeah, like what is the mystery at its heart here? Like, what is it? That's so from the surrealist, and you can see exactly why the surrealist would be into it. And if you were building a library, like you would build if you were building a pulp library in the same way that you would build like a Scarecrow video, like you could have a labyrinth of pulp, and you could have your little section over here of like syphilitic pulp, Lair of the White Worm. You know, you could have like whereas like Bram Stoker was out of his mind on syphilis, and it was affecting his plots, and it was affecting what he was writing.
Well, and then another just undeniable strain of this stuff is how absolutely colonialist and racist it is.
Mm-hmm. Fu Manchu
being a prime example.
Yeah.
You can watch now like the movie with Karloff, and his stated goal is the extermination of the white race, and so he becomes an almost sympathetic hero of the movie, but it's born out of just the most obscene, you know, yellow peril racism. And there's so much, you know, jungle pulp and mm-hmm. all this stuff that's just...
Do you like Franco's Fu Manchu movies?
I do like those.
Yeah, me too. I love yeah. it. Those to me are just like, and most people just, if you put those movies over most people, they would not hang.
Well, Franco is another guy who picks up so many of these pulp
screens. You guys have a print of, Agfa has a print of Castle Fu Manchu, by the way.
Should just stick that in some yeah. Monday 10 slot or something. Yeah. Why not?
I would come and co-present that if you wanted me to.
All right, I'll see if there's room.
All right.
Franco's relationship to pulp.
Yeah.
You know, he does jazz pulp. He takes these sort of, I don't know, almost like this DNA. This is like something so just unspeakably primal. Whatever it is that's in pulp that is that primal thing, and he filters it through, you know, that perspective of jazz.
It's like he writes with it in real time. Uh-huh. You know, he writes with the pulp pen in real time, and you're seeing it happen. You're seeing all those things spilling out of his pulp pen of a camera. And that's talking about pulp, it's the same thing as like talking about Franco. It's like, it's so hard to even communicate what you love about Franco, because some people are like, oh yeah, 70s titties. Uh-huh. Like, they watch Jess Franco, that's kind of what they get out of it. But it's like...
Well, and it's a I think a lot thing. Of that has to do just, you know, people come to him through probably horror more than anything mm-hmm. else,
yeah,
but
yeah.
then also just sexploitation, and that's not where he's coming from. That's what he's putting his work into. It's into that milieu, into that world, but
where
that's
he can get a budget, yeah, from. Yeah, also.
Like, that's not the impulse that he's working with.
Like, if you're like, oh no, I'm really interested in horror movies, and you watch like Bare-Breasted Countess, you know. If you're like, no, I'm really into like Nightmare on Elm Street, and then you watch like Bare-Breasted Countess, you'll be like, that sucked and it was so boring.
Yeah, well, it doesn't even feel like a movie.
Yeah. Yeah, it doesn't feel like it feels like something so different. It's really weird that that's really one of his most seen movies, and it's one of his most poetic and difficult movies. Mm-hmm. I wonder how many people are still listening.
We're wrapping up about half an hour ago. I don't know, where else can we take this?
I'd really like to think a lot more about the pulp imagination, and like, yeah, a lot of it has, yeah, like reading in Borges and just reading among pulp novels and frustratingly throwing down pulp novels sometimes because you can't, like, you can't hang with like the repetition sometimes, but getting what you can get out of it. Like, ever tried to read like Svengali?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's like, some of those, because they were written for like weekly publication, are so repetitive and so time bitey.
Yeah, even the stuff you like. And then when you get into the cinematic world of serials, you mm-hmm. hit that same thing where it's like you know, a good chapter of a Republic serial is about as sublime and pure mm-hmm. and wonderful of a cinematic experience as you have. And then you watch another one, and that's cut in half, and you get exponentially diminishing returns.
I love serials, but I have not watched a lot of chapter 15s of serials. I'll say that much.
I think for the super crime series, and in lieu of pre-show, I'm just going to set up the 16s, and we'll run chapters. But I haven't decided if we'll do a full one straight through, or if we'll just sort of pick and choose.
You know what I always thought would be fun to do would be to do like four serial chapters in a row, and then the next week do four chapter twos.
Even four is too many, though. Oh, four different.
I don't know. Like, I can't think of a single serial right now.
Do Captain Marvel and Zorro's Fighting Legion. Daredevils of the Red Circle.
Right. You've got Nyoka, the Jungle Girl.
All of these directed by William Whitney and John English. It's they're the masters of the form.
I just watched a different Alamo showed for Weird Wednesday showed Darktown Shredders last week, mm-hmm. which weirdly is a John Whitney movie or a William Whitney movie. And last night I watched Juvenile Jungle, which I'd never seen before, which is a great William Whitney movie.
Tarantino obviously is one of his most vocal supporters, and I think he mostly likes him for the Roy Rogers Western stuff.
Yeah, that's weird.
Yeah, I can't hang. I've watched a few of them. They're not bad, but that's not.
You know what those have going for them that is really beautiful? And this is the case of all those Republic Westerns, of which I'd rather watch an Alan Lane movie than a Roy Rogers movie for mm-hmm. some reason. But anyway, what they really have going for them is those beautiful locations that that Republic had, and their mm-hmm. camera cars, and like those beautiful horses. It's like, and their music score. I mean, there's something beautifully ambient about those mm-hmm. films. Spending time with that kind of California sun and that kind of California landscape. It's just kind of like a hangout movie with those cowboys. But Roy Rogers and Dale Evans, I find just to be boring people to be around.
Yeah, I mean, Trigger's the star of the damn movies.
Trigger's beautiful, yeah.
But yeah,
we've gotten so far around in the podcast that we're talking about Trigger.
I mentioned Singing Cowboys rather early
on. Yeah, you did. Yeah, we've been... I'm just going to call this the Singing Cowboys podcast.
Should we try some harmonies? All right, that pregnant pause said no. But yeah, that the repetition of pulp mm-hmm. is like both one of its biggest stumbling blocks to like ever spending the time to like delve deep all at once,
mm-hmm.
and also just like such an inherent quality that it is so elastically repetitious. And you see it in comic books especially,
mm-hmm.
that these characters that now have existed for 75, 80 years are static and yet always evolving. And I think there's like something very pulp in that, where it's, you have like a premise, a situation, it has, you know, whatever qualities of mystery, of adventure, of intrigue, and then it just repeats. And it repeats with minor variation.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's probably why Jess Franco's into it, now that I say it out loud, because it has that jazz quality of riffing on melodies. And
yeah, chorus comes around again in jazz, but it's not the same. It's mm-hmm. different.
And it builds. And it's...
What's influenced...
We take it back to even De Palma, where everyone calls De Palma derivative of Hitchcock, or, you know, did when they were trying to mm-hmm. run him down, but it's additive. He takes that and he builds on it, he uses it, he incorporates it into his vocabulary, and it becomes something new, and yet it's still just very much a straightforward thriller.
Yeah, the facile, smart guy, you know, when Sisters came out, would have said, oh, I don't need to see that, I've already seen Hitchcock, you know, and everybody would have said, oh, that was so smart and perceptive of you.
Mm-hmm.
But in fact, it doesn't take into account that everything that's gone into that, you know, Hitchcock has helped to form the sort of shape of it, but everything else that goes into that, like, it's like they're just missing that.
Yeah.
Or they don't care enough to look into what that is. By the way, have you seen De Palma's first film?
Murder a la Mod?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's amazing, isn't it? Like,
there's so much just like raw talent on display, and it's such a just a weird kind of mess of a thing.
But it's so De Palma. It's like
so. Yeah, I mean
that's the thing that blew me away about it. I was like, oh, it'll be like almost anybody else's film that they would have made on this budget level, like along this time. I wasn't expecting it to see something that was that much of a pure expression of his art.
Yeah, I mean it's that true auteur thing where it's just the obsessions are there and the obsessions are recapitulated again and again and again.
It was like that movie's like a De Palma bouillon cube,
you know? Yeah, I really love the early De Palmas. We're not running any of them this time around, but Greetings and High Mom specifically are such a good pair of movies.
Yeah, you could really go back and do like kind of a weird, just in the same way that you would do like an Altman or a Hitchcock Deep Track series, you could do like a pretty cool De Palma Deep Track series next year and do home movies. I mean, if you could find them.
Yeah, I really didn't even look into the availability of any of that.
Nah, you wouldn't for a series like that, like this, but like maybe it's a hit and maybe like people, maybe there's like a demand for that. There's probably 100 other things you'd rather do than a Deep Tracks De Palma series.
Yeah, it's true. I don't genuinely see us going back to there, but in the privacy of your home, well worth your time.
You know what's another movie that people don't get? Is Dressed to Kill. Like, that's another movie that people, like, so many people looked at that and go, yeah, no, it's fine. Basic, like, slasher type movie.
Yeah, and I mean, it's also one of his most controversial, and I feel, in a sense, that's well-earned, but in a sense, it's off-base, too, because, you know, I think a lot of the criticism that came against it at the time was that it was misogynistic because it was about violence towards women, but I think, you know, there's so much going on in a De Palma movie that to write him off as misogynistic because violence happens towards women in his movies is really reductive, but to look at Dressed to Kill and to think that the sort of the psychoanalysis of it is that the killer is a trans woman because she's a trans woman is just so fundamentally problematic and like deeply upsetting and offensive that it probably really ages more poorly than any of his other movies.
But it gives it depth, you know, it gives it like this sort of social depth as well.
It's a thing. I would never not show it for that reason, but I would definitely, you know, center that in the discussion around it.
Yeah, it's also just a movie, you know. It's just a machine.
Movie. It is a movie to the nth degree.
Yeah. I think it's weird. I think maybe the most overrated De Palma movie is Blowout, which I think has achieved a much greater reputation than maybe it deserves.
Yeah, I mean, it ends with such a sort of cathartic ecstasy of cinema that it's sticks with you, but as a whole piece, not, I don't know, not so much.
It did become like, maybe after like Tarantino, you know, said his piece about it, then it became everybody's like, you know, but De Palma, it's Blow Up and or Blowout and everything else. But it's I don't think Blowout's as good as Dressed to Kill. I mean, I don't know.
De Palma's also a filmmaker that you can't demand a good movie. And I think this is, you know, really what distinguishes advanced movie watching from casual movie watching is that the movie as a whole doesn't need to be a good thing, but there needs to be qualities in there that are worthwhile. And I think, you know, that's something that a lot of people really struggle with when they aren't, you know, deep into movies, is that if it doesn't hang together as this, like, good narrative with characters that are identifiable and, you know, familiar in a way, that they can't get the rest of the stuff out of it. And I think it's kind of a one-on-one thing in terms of becoming someone who's into movies, but it's worth articulating, I think, that you have to find pieces of a movie and draw them out and not just look at it as a whole.
There may be those pieces that are so incredibly meaningful. Somebody one time said about a novel, and I don't remember whose definition of a novel this was, maybe you'll know, said a novel is a book of a certain length that has something wrong with it. And that's kind of the case of all great movies. It's like, it's a film of a certain length that has something wrong with it.
And it's like when you watch something from the production code era of classic Hollywood, so many people get hung up on how they don't end well, how the endings contradict what they're about. And it's like, well, yeah, there was a production code that made them do it this way. It doesn't necessarily, like, you know, what's in there is in there.
Even before the production code, sometimes it was just like, oh, no, there were social there were social reasons why this happened. Did you see Mexicali Rose?
No.
We showed that as part of the Precode Stamick series.
Uh-huh.
That movie, like, it's Barbara Stamick's third movie. It's her first, like, real starring, big starring role. She plays, like, this bad woman who, like, comes and seduces this, you know, widowed man, and then this whole thing happens. But she has, like, the most delectable, amoral fun all the way through, and she's desirable, and she's just having a great time. She's having all this sex and everything, and like it gets to the very end of the film, and spoiler alert if you don't want to know this, and then like at the very end of the film she like just like jumps off a cliff or something, and it's like literally like the last 30 seconds of the film, and it's like, oh well, she got what was coming to her or something.
Mm-hmm. So, it's something that's articulated really well by Janine Basinger in her book about women's cinema and melodrama.
Mm-hmm.
Where, you know, those become movies that mean something to women of the time because, not because of how they end, but because of the behaviors and the alternatives that they're able to illustrate in the middle.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, you know, if a woman gets a divorce, becomes an independent woman, goes out on her own, very likely the, you know, the necessities of storytelling is going to punish her or end her up with a man or something.
Mm-hmm.
But because within the movie you get to see this behavior modeled, it's brought to life by this glamorous movie star, it becomes something that you can take out of that, and it's not tethered to the overall story structure of the thing, but it's an identifiable element that, you know, is genuinely revolutionary.
And that's something Pauline Kael writes about Christopher Strong. She's like, and then like this moment happens where, I think it's Christopher Strong, where it's like, okay, then this, you know, you're cruising along, but then like this choice has to be made, and it's like she writes about like all women have sank down in their seats, you know, at this moment in a film.
Mm-hmm.
Where she talks about how that happens, but you what's important is like what's in the middle of the sandwich. It's not the two pieces of bread on the end, you know, that were like the ways that it actually made it to the screen. Like in the same way that you'll hear like black people talk about like how huge it was to see like Woody Strode playing a secondary character. It's like,
and you watch those movies now and you're like, this doesn't feel positive, you know, this doesn't feel like a great representation. This isn't, I don't see the value in this, but thinking about it in that context, that here's someone on screen.
Mm-hmm.
And going back even to, you know, groups that are no longer marginalized have been fully incorporated into whiteness, like the Irish. They had James Cagney, who was an embodiment of us on screen. It doesn't matter what he's doing, that's me up on screen. Or John Garfield for Jews. It's like, this is
mm-hmm.
our guy.
Yeah, and this is our just root for this guy.
The value of representation is undeniably powerful, and there's still just a huge problem of representation in media now.
It's true, Tommy. We've got to wrap it up because
this has been a
lot.
Okay,
in.
Yeah, this is.
We've been talking for hour 38.
All right, that's a podcast.
It's been a great talk. I would have enjoyed this talk whether it was a podcast or not. All right, so. Thank you so much, Tommy. We're going to wrap it up. I hope people will come and see a lot of the stuff that you have coming up at Ritz. Hope to also see stuff we have coming up at AFS. And
Let's get some plugs in there. What do you got?
Plugs. Oh, the Surrealist Love Goddess series is happening now. We haven't announced it yet, but we're doing an Ida Lupino series in August that I'm also really excited about.
Just her directorial or beyond?
Three films of Ida Lupino acting, and then one, and then The Hitchhiker, which she directed.
Mm.
And then I hope at some point we can, maybe some new prints will be made of some stuff so we can show Hard, Fast, and Beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
And some other of her films that she directed.
Awesome. Good stuff.
Yeah.
Thank you for having me. This has been a very fun.
It's been a lot of fun. It's always fun talking to you. Thanks for joining us. Goodbye, everybody.